We would be particularly thrilled to have Mrs. Truman and Miss Margaret join you on that occasion. Graham then cannily suggested that such a favor could benefit the president and his party. Truman had talked of appointing an ambassador to the Vatican. Republicans saw this as a cynical political maneuver designed to nail down the Catholic vote in an election year. And many Protestants, whatever their party affiliation, opposed such an appointment on religious grounds. Aware that the president was in a tight spot, Graham said, "Due to some of the unfavorable publicity connected with the Vatican issue, I sincerely believe it would be of some advantage to you to join with us on that opening Sunday. You may be interested to know that I have refused to make any comment on the Vatican appointment, because I didn't want to be put in the position of opposing you." A few days later, a White House memo reported that at Key West, the president said very decisively that he did not wish to endorse Billy Graham's Washington revival. And particularly, he said he did not want to receive him at the White House. You remember what a show of himself Billy Graham made the last time he was here. The president does not want it repeated. When the inevitable request came, Harry Truman's very decisive declination was sanitized by his secretary into a polite, "I'm very sorry, I must send you a disappointing reply." Graham was disappointed, to be sure. The president's approval would be a marvelous coup, irrefutable evidence that he and his ministry had national significance. At the same time, he felt Mr. Truman was making a tactical error. Just 4 days before the opening service, he wrote to the president's secretary, informing him that this campaign is being watched with probably more interest than probably any religious event since the founding of the World Council of Churches in Amsterdam. And I do feel it would be advantageous for the president to give some word or make a personal appearance at some time during these meetings. The president was not persuaded, but Graham would not give up. Like Jacob wrestling with the angel, he seemed determined not to let go until he had wrung a blessing from his adversary. When Truman made good on his promise not to attend the opening service, Graham set a new goal. If Sam Rayburn and Congress could set aside normal regulations to permit him to preach on the Capitol steps, surely the president could set aside an hour or two to attend that service. Jerry Bevin sent Truman a resolution by 225 ministers who urged him to be present at that rally. Graham followed immediately with a letter noting that ABC would broadcast the service coast to coast and that the clergy of the Washington area, together with literally thousands of their colleagues, would rejoice to know that their chief executive was in attendance on this occasion. He then called the White House to issue a personal plea that Truman attend the service. An aide who took the call reported that Graham stressed that he believes the president will go down in history as one of the most courageous men of all times, reiterated his refusal to speak out on the Vatican issue, and observed that his ministry had received some favorable publicity from various publications. This time, Truman's secretary informed Graham that a previous engagement would preclude the president's attendance at the service, but that he is nonetheless grateful for the kind thought which prompted your invitation, and sends you his best wishes. Finally, Graham stopped pestering the White House. He recognized he had been rebuffed. A Time magazine story described Truman's non-appearance as a snubbing, but he resisted prophetic rebuke, limiting himself to a mild, "I guess he was just too busy or something." Privately, he may have taken pleasure in reports that the rally drew a bigger crowd than had Truman's inauguration. Harry Truman may have regarded Graham as a rube to be avoided, but other politicians saw him either as a kindred spirit or as someone whose friendship could convey a blessing. Approximately one-third of all senators and one-fourth of House members asked for a special allocation of seats for crusade services, and scores of congressmen attended the Capitol rally. With the help of such friends, Graham secured permission to hold prayer sessions at the Pentagon each noon throughout the crusade. Virginia Senator A. Willis Robertson, father of religious broadcaster and 1988 Republican presidential candidate M.G. Pat Robertson, boosted Graham by authoring a unanimous Senate resolution to be read at a crusade prayer service, urging Americans to pray that God may guide and protect our nation and preserve the peace of the world. Graham's sojourn in Washington also led to acquaintance with two men who would become his close and controversial friends, Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, the latter another favorite of Sid Richardson's. Of greater immediate moment, however, the attention he received apparently convinced Graham that he and his supporters wielded considerable political clout. Late in 1951, he had expressed the opinion, foreshadowing later predictions by the religious right, that the Christian people of America will not sit idly by in 1952. They are going to vote as a bloc for the man with the strongest moral and spiritual platform, regardless of his views on other matters. I believe we can hold the balance of power. This bloc, he suggested, would be a coordinated effort in which church members would follow the instructions of their religious leaders. During the Washington Crusade, he announced his desire to interview every potential candidate from both parties, revealing he had already met with Senator Estes Kefauver and General Douglas MacArthur. "He is one of the most inspirational men I've ever met. He is deeply religious." And expected to visit General Eisenhower during a March visit to Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, SHAPE, near Paris. "The only one who has turned me down," he noted pointedly, "is President Truman. I will not ask for another appointment." Though careful to note that he would refrain from a public endorsement, he told reporters that he might well share his personal choice with a number of religious leaders who probably will use my views as a guide. He was also willing to commend his views to candidates. "If I could run for president of the United States today," he volunteered, "on a platform of calling the people back to God, back to Christ, back to the Bible, I'd be elected. There is a hunger for God today." At first, Graham brushed off any suggestion of personal desire for political office, but statements such as this stirred some imaginations. And a few months later, he told reporters that numerous congressmen and former members of Roosevelt's cabinet had approached him to run for the United States Senate from North Carolina, or perhaps even to consider the presidency in 1956. Apparently, he did not consider such suggestions far-fetched. America had not yet reached a crisis that demanded he sacrifice his ministry to enter politics, he said. But if that should happen, he stood ready to help. "If the country ever comes close to communism, I will offer myself in any capacity to lead the Christian people of this country in the preservation of their God-given democratic institutions." In the meantime, he estimated he could swing at least 16 million votes to the cause or candidate of his choice. Despite Graham's profession of neutrality during the early stages of the presidential campaign, it appears he already suspected who his choice would be. Several months earlier, in a letter to Sid Richardson, he expressed a highly positive evaluation of Dwight Eisenhower, named, it was said, for Dwight Moody, and a hope that the general would seek the presidency. Richardson shared the letter with Ike, who wrote to Graham in November 1951, thanking him for the overgenerous personal allusions your letter made to me, and commending him for his fight for the old-fashioned virtues of integrity, decency, and straightforwardness in public life. Richardson then proposed to Graham that he write General Eisenhower some good reasons why you think he ought to run for the presidency. Graham protested, "Mr. Sid, I can't get involved in politics." The canny old operator pushed this objection aside. "There's no politics," he said. "Don't you think any American ought to run if millions of people want him to?" When Graham agreed, Richardson grumped, "Say that in a letter." And Graham did as he was bidden. Eisenhower's earlier note to Graham was apparently a formal courtesy, and his compliments were generated by Sid Richardson's appraisal of the evangelist rather than any first-hand knowledge. But this missive caught his attention, and he asked Richardson, "Who was that young preacher you had write me? It was the darndest letter I ever got. I'd like to meet him sometime." Given this encouragement, Graham promptly requested an interview, and Eisenhower agreed, though he insisted that his position as SHAPE commander ruled out any early declaration of intentions. In later years, Graham has minimized his role in Eisenhower's decision to seek the presidency, claiming his was just one voice among many. According to Jerry Bevin, who met with Eisenhower and his staff at Fontainebleau, to iron out details of Graham's visit. Richardson and several of his Texas cronies specifically assigned Billy the task of persuading the general to enter the campaign, and the Fontainebleau meeting proved pivotal in that decision. Graham continued to feign impartiality, even to the point of declining invitations by both major parties to lead the opening prayer at their national conventions. But it was not hard to discern where his sentiments lay. He repeatedly criticized the Truman administration for the way America had entered the Korean conflict and for lack of resolve in pursuing victory. "How many of you voted to go into the Korean War?" he often asked, noting that, "I never did." The decision had been made by one man sitting in Washington, and just as all inherit the burden of Adam's original sin in the Garden of Eden. When Mr. Truman went to war in Korea, you and I went to war in Korea, whether we liked it or not. He told a Houston audience in May 1952, "The Korean War is being fought because the nation's leaders blundered on foreign policy in the Far East. I do not think the men in Washington have any grasp of the Oriental mind." Alger Hiss shaped our foreign policy, and some of the men who formulate it now have never been to the East. The administration then compounded its original error, he charged, by refusing to follow General MacArthur's advice to take whatever measures were necessary to win. Choosing instead to drag out the war in a cowardly and half-hearted fashion at a cost of nearly 2,000 American lives each week. Throughout the spring and summer, Graham echoed the sentiments and sometimes the exact phrases of the Republican campaign, observing that it was time for a change, time to elect new leaders who would clean up the mess in Washington, time to get a new foreign policy to end this bloodletting in Korea. Asserting that we all seem to agree there's a mess in Washington, he proclaimed that the nation desperately needs a strong spiritual leader who has the fortitude and moral courage to clean out the grafters and hangers-on. A Moses or a Daniel or a general to lead them in this hour. After Eisenhower gained the Republican nomination, Graham visited him at the Brown Palace Hotel in Denver and presented him with a red Bible, which the general apparently kept with him and read frequently throughout the campaign. At this same meeting, Eisenhower confided his concern that the public did not perceive him to be a religious man. To make a show of religion during a campaign, he feared, would appear insincere. But he told Graham he intended to join a church immediately following the election, win or lose. Whether the general's approach was guileless or craftily calculating, it won Graham's admiration, and the story found its way into the newspapers. Without question, Eisenhower recognized the potential value of Graham's goodwill. In the early stages of the campaign, he wrote to Washington Governor Arthur Langley, co-chair of Graham's 1951 Seattle Crusade, acknowledging Graham's power to reach millions of voters and expressing his pleasure in the evangelist's commendation of his crusade for honesty in government during several hour of decision radio broadcasts. Clearly, Eisenhower hoped for more, even though he recognized Graham and other religious leaders would have to be circumspect in their support. Since all pastors must necessarily take a nonpartisan approach, he conceded, it would be difficult to form any formal organization of religious leaders to work on our behalf. However, this might be done in an informal way, and I am passing a copy of this letter on to campaign advisor Arthur Summerfield. If you have further thoughts along this line, I would be most grateful for them. Perhaps because they doubted his influence or feared some kind of backlash, Eisenhower's staff was ambivalent toward Graham. They acknowledged that the general likes and admires the evangelist, but attempted to limit the number and length of his visits. Keeping Graham's favor proved wise. Not only did he continue to make Republican-flavored comments, but a few days before the November election, he revealed to the press that although he was still not taking sides, a personal survey of nearly 200 churchmen and religious editors from 30 states and 22 denominations indicated that 77% favored Eisenhower for president, while only 13% indicated an intention to vote for Democratic candidate Adlai Stevenson. Predictably, such gestures won Eisenhower's appreciation and affection, and after his thumping victory in the election, led to Graham's being asked to serve as a religious consultant for the inauguration ceremonies. The Washington Crusade and his developing relationship with Eisenhower enhanced Graham's symbolic importance as an official spokesman for Protestant Christianity. During the fall of 1952, he began to receive letters from chaplains and servicemen asking him to visit troops in Korea during the Christmas season. Cardinal Spellman visited the troops under the auspices of the Defense Department, but Graham was unable at first to obtain government sponsorship for his trip and was obliged to pay his own expenses, an inequity Harold Akinge and other evangelicals vehemently criticized. Jerry Bevin and friends in Congress, however, helped reduce Pentagon resistance to a morale-boosting visit, and accompanied by Grady Wilson and Bob Pierce, president of the evangelical relief organization World Vision, Graham soon set out on his first visit to the Far East, grandly announcing his plan to duck from bunker to bunker along the front to assure the boys that prayers are being said for them at Christmas time. In Tokyo, where he lunched with the emperor's brother, visited wounded soldiers, and addressed nearly 750 missionaries. I was told, he reported, that this was the largest gathering of missionaries on a mission field in history. He was called in for an unexpected visit with General Mark Clark, Supreme Allied Commander in the Far East. On the day following that visit, Graham and his party received word that the Pentagon had decided not only to sponsor their trip, but had ordered first-class treatment throughout their stay in Korea. With clear delight, Billy exulted, we all became VIPs. And on returning home, disingenuously told his supporters of a privileged train trip in a general's private command car, of having a full escort with about 10 jeeps to meet us, and an entire staff lined up for review, of being briefed by every commanding general in every area, and of being repeatedly offered the seat assigned by protocol to generals. The tour, however, was hardly an exercise in vainglory. At almost every stop, Graham and his colleagues visited orphanages set up by American GIs, and in many cases, supported by World Vision, to care for children who had lost their families in the war. He was equally diligent in visiting numerous hospitals and MASH, Mobile Army Surgical Hospital units, where wounded soldiers were being treated. He saw for the first time sights that exceeded his imagination. Men with their eyes shot out, their arms mutilated, gaping wounds in their sides and back, their skin charred by horrible burns. A big, tough Marine so shredded by enemy bullets that there was not enough body left to be made whole again. When one man, permanently paralyzed and lying face down in a canvas and aluminum rigging, said, Mr. Graham, I would like to see your face. Billy lay on his back, fighting tears as he softly talked and prayed with him. Seeing his countrymen suffer strengthened his conviction that Washington should seek a swift and decisive end to such carnage. But it did not make him a warmonger. I wish every American could stand in the hospitals with me, he said. They would have a new sense of the horror of war. And he recognized that Americans were not the only ones to suffer. After seeing a communist POW who had been burned by a liquid fire, he said, watching him, I could not help but think of the terrible suffering that goes on in the communist armies as well. I offered a prayer for them too, for our God is not only the God of the Americans, but also of the communists. I am convinced that we as Christians should pray daily for our communist enemies. Graham reckoned he had wept more in Korea than in the past several years put together. These experiences changed my life. I could never be quite the same again. I felt sadder, older. I felt as though I had gone in a boy and come out a man. Billy was scarcely less moved by his encounters with Korean Christians, who were already showing the dedication that would produce explosive Christian growth over the next 40 years. In Busan, shielded from sub-freezing winds by a fleece-lined parka and heavy boots, and from possible communist attack by a phalanx of military police brandishing rifles and machine guns, he spoke for 4 nights from an open-air platform to several thousand Koreans and GIs who sat on tiny straw mats or stood in the mud to hear him. In Seoul, he attended prayer meetings that began at 5 o'clock in the morning. And in Taegu and other cities, he was shamed by Korean pastors who gripped his hand in gratitude for his coming, great tears coursing down their cheeks. I felt so humble as I stood with these men, he said. I was not worthy to loosen their shoe latchets. These men had suffered persecution for Christ. Their families had been killed because of their testimony for Christ. Their homes were gone. They had nothing of worldly possessions. And here they were, coming to listen to me preach the gospel and thanking me for it. They were preaching to me, but they did not know it. He was particularly moved by two pastors he invited to speak on an Hour of Decision broadcast he was sending back to America. Neither had ever spoken on the radio, and Graham noticed one turning his head to brush back a tear just before his turn to speak. Here, he marveled, were men who had faced death 100 times and who had suffered untold agonies for Christ, afraid before a microphone. My heart was deeply touched. As promised, Graham spent several days, including Christmas, at the battlefront itself, flying in small planes and helicopters through thick fog, and so close to enemy artillery that exploding shells jarred the aircraft several times. He landed at tiny airstrips, donned a helmet and flak jacket as soon as he hit the ground, and preached to hundreds of grimy, unshaven, and fully armed GIs, some of whom had just returned from combat. On one hillside, he preached from a makeshift platform decorated with an enormous painting of Jesus, watching over a Marine who had dropped his head on his arms to get a moment of rest during a break from battle. The picture had been painted in a front-line trench and trundled 40 miles under cover of darkness in time for the service. After preaching, he spent as much time as possible visiting with the men, signing their Bibles. "Usually I avoid signing my name in Bibles," he said, "but here it was a privilege. Some of these Bibles were pierced and torn by bullets or shrapnel. All of them looked used and well-read, and going into trenches and bunkers to talk with those on active duty." Without exception, Graham found the men unusually receptive to his message, which he delivered without adornment. The brevity of his trip did not deter Graham from feeling he had obtained a good grasp of the situation in Korea. Typically, and for the most part, he was highly positive. After a visit with South Korean President Syngman Rhee, arranged with the assistance of General James Van Fleet, he judged that the president seems to have a firm grip on the country. Virtually every general he met impressed him as a gracious man of outstanding character, and he declared he had never seen a private organization operate as efficiently as does the Army. The food is excellent, and medical care is unsurpassed anywhere. The soldiers he talked to were the finest of American youth. Everyone was a rugged he-man, a courageous, red-blooded American, yet with such an interest in spiritual matters that he never saw a pin-up picture at the front. Within a few days of his arrival, he blithely offered the rather damning and simplistic observation that if President Truman had taken time to visit Korea, he would have ended the war. Then, apparently to compensate for Truman's oversight, he announced he had his own plan to end the conflict and hoped to share it with President-elect Eisenhower as soon as he returned to the United States. His plan was a national day of prayer for God's help in finding the precise solution to the war. Eisenhower apparently decided to rely on secular military expertise. The war continued for 16 more months. Graham wielded greater influence in the spiritual realm. Eisenhower became the first president ever to lead a prayer as part of his own inauguration, and shortly afterward he was baptized and became a communicant in the Presbyterian Church. Graham insists that both these actions were at the president's own initiative, but he quickly stepped forward to applaud them and to assure his followers that the nation was in good hands once again. It has been my privilege during the past year to talk with Mr. Eisenhower on two occasions, he told his radio audience. I have been deeply impressed by his sincerity, humility, and tremendous grasp of world affairs. I also sense a dependence upon God. He told me on both occasions that the hope of building a better America lay in a spiritual revival. He added, another thing that encourages me about Mr. Eisenhower is that he is taking advice from some genuine born-again Christians. In 1953, Graham conducted crusades in half a dozen American cities, the most successful a 4-week effort in Dallas, at whose climactic closing service he filled the 75,000-seat Cotton Bowl in the largest evangelistic meeting ever held in America to that point. In what would become a regular practice, he sent Eisenhower a report on the crusade, noting that the record-breaking crowd had lit matches and asked God's blessing on the president. He then asked in what would become a typical gambit, if it might be possible to have a short chat with you about a matter of great importance. This crusade was also notable in that it marked the occasion of Graham's formally placing his membership with the First Baptist Church in Dallas. His reason for maintaining membership in a church so far from his home in Montreat was disarmingly simple. If I belonged to a Baptist church in the neighborhood, they would continually be asking me to work in church affairs. When I'm at home, I attend my wife's Presbyterian church, and naturally they don't ask me to do anything. He did not mention that the Dallas church was also the largest Southern Baptist congregation in the world. That year, Graham also published Peace with God, an extended statement of the theology and social thought contained in his sermons. A Christian Century reviewer declared that as writing, it is just the dullest in a long, long time. The great evangelist wouldn't have been caught dead preaching this pedestrian stuff. It never gets off the ground. And so help me, I can't see how any amount of triple fortissimo sincerity ever gives it flight. He also predicted that ministers who had welcomed Graham's crusades would withdraw their support after seeing what he really believed. In an ironic coincidence, the same reviewer praised a book written by Charles Templeton, describing Graham's old friend as alone in the Billy Sunday line in the verve and vitality of his preaching. The great ones were original and repeatable and quotable and aphoristic. Among the headliners today, only Templeton is that. He is by himself in the grand tradition. Despite such criticism, Peace with God, written not for the theologians and philosophers, but for the man in the streets, and subsequently translated into 38 languages, has sold more than 2 million copies and remains a useful compendium of the essential content of Billy Graham's theology and preaching. He sent one of the first copies to President Eisenhower. As he would throughout his life, Graham struggled with his fame and success. He realized he was achieving near iconic status in the minds of a great many people. Near the conclusion of his Greensboro crusade, he told his audience, "I know you are going to be attached to this place. When this tabernacle is torn down a month from now, thousands of you will cry, and you'll come in here and pick blades of grass to keep in your Bibles as souvenirs. I know you will. I've seen it happen." Allowing his associates and others to refer to him as Dr. Graham, on the grounds that the honorific title was useful in appealing to a higher type of social strata, reflected his striving for human approbation, just as his soon expressed preference for Mr. Graham, or simply Billy, reflected his concern that such striving was inappropriate. His currying favor with presidents and other notables made it clear that at some level, not far beneath the surface, he relished the publicity and prestige he attained. But he passed over handsome opportunities to capitalize on them as fully as he might have. He rejected an opportunity to play Billy Sunday in a feature film. And when NBC offered him $1 million a year to host a regular television program, he turned it down with scarcely a second thought, observing that he would not be willing to trade with the richest man on earth if it meant detracting from his work as an evangelist. While Billy built his career as an itinerant evangelist, Ruth worked with comparable intensity to construct a stable home life for their growing family. A third daughter, named Ruth, but known from birth as Bunny, because she looked like a rabbit, had arrived late in 1950. And in 1952, the Grahams finally got a son, William Franklin III. "I'd have loved another girl," Billy said, "but every man needs a son." With the aid of the Bells, who lived across the street and served as full-time grandparents, Ruth gave the children a great deal of nurturing attention. But Billy's long absences from Montreat could not but take a toll. Once when Ruth brought Ann to a crusade and let her surprise her father while he was talking on the telephone, he stared at the toddler with a blank look, not recognizing his own daughter. In a turnabout a few years later, young Franklin greeted his father's homecoming from a crusade with a puzzled, "Who he?" The rest of the world, however, knew who he was. and that inevitably impinged on the family's privacy. "We were on the sightseeing tour," Ruth recalled. "If the cars just kept going, we thought they were probably from the Episcopal Center. If they just slowed down, we thought they were probably Presbyterians. The ones that actually stopped, got out of the bus, came down and looked in the bedroom windows and wondered all over, we knew they were from Ridgecrest, a Baptist conference center on the other side of Black Mountain. It got to be a joke. Bill said I was prejudiced against the Baptists, but that's the way they were. They were so friendly, too friendly." Displaying a bit of their father's enterprise, the children capitalized on the attention. Gigi and Ann once stretched a rope across the road and demanded a dollar from those who stopped to look at their home. Bunny used a more subtle form of extortion. When Ruth commented that she always seemed to have more money than her allowance would warrant, Bunny innocently told her, "Just watch the next time a bus stops." Ruth recalls, not without some pleasure, that "we watched, and she had her little red pocketbook on her arm, and she wandered up to the gate where the bus was parked with her wistful little face and the pocketbook on her arm, and the inevitable happened. I put a stop to that." Ruth practiced a somewhat more lax form of discipline than Billy Frank and his siblings had endured. Despite Billy's occasional comments on the benefits of corporal punishment and the children's memory of frequent spankings, some acquaintances from this period remember that the Graham youngsters were less than models of decorum in their behavior at church and other public gatherings. Few, however, would criticize the children's spiritual development. Motherhood and other domestic demands had not altered Ruth's lifelong devotional bent. She usually kept an open Bible out on the counter, and sometimes carried one in her hand to read while she vacuumed the floor. She saw to it that the children observed a daily family altar, similar in form and content to those on which she and Billy had been reared, though she always kept it short, lest the children come to resent it. She also took special pains to make her husband's absences seem normal, following the advice of an old black man who had told her, "Make the least of all that goes, and the most of all that comes." Leave-taking was always kept unemotional, as if it were no more significant than a trip to the hardware store. And if the children commented on their father's absence, they were told he had gone somewhere to tell the people about Jesus. Gigi remembered that Mother never said, "Daddy's going away for a month." Instead, she would say, "Daddy will be home in a month. We'll do such and such before he comes back." She also noted, particularly when she was younger, that, "I thought everyone's daddy was gone. And my granddaddy was such a father figure for us that it never hit me that it was all that unusual." Whether perceived as unusual or not, the children did notice their father's absence. Once Ruth saw one of the girls sitting on the lawn, staring wistfully at an airplane in the distance and calling out, "Bye, Daddy. Bye, Daddy." A plane meant Daddy was going somewhere. "How much we missed him," Ruth said. "Only each one knows." She read Billy's letters aloud, guided the children as they prayed for their father and his work, and on Sunday afternoons gathered them together to listen to his voice on the Hour of Decision broadcast. Afterward, he usually called to talk with each of them. It was not easy, but both Billy and Ruth were determined not to let his career exact the kind of painful price the children of evangelists too often paid. "I like to think," Graham reflected, "that we learned something about satisfying a growing child's need for a father, even though he was so often away from home." Chapter 10. Trust and Obey. In keeping with his modest aspiration to know nothing save Jesus Christ and Him crucified, Billy Graham's theology was anything but abstruse. The heart of his teaching was, and would ever remain, a short list of straightforward affirmations. A sovereign God has revealed His will to humans in the Bible, His inspired, accurate, and fully dependable Word. Humans are sinful and corrupt, but if they accept God's offer of grace, made possible by the redeeming work of the crucified, risen, and living Christ, their sinful nature can be supernaturally transformed, born again, and after death, they will live forever in heaven. Without question, the simplicity of this scheme helps account for the widespread and enduring popularity of evangelical Christianity. It is easily understood, and despite its negative view of human nature, essentially optimistic. Though it may not be easy, humans can readily do what they need to do. God will do the rest, and the rewards are infinite. To many, many people, that is indeed good news. Later in his career, Graham would devote entire books to such subjects as the Holy Spirit, angels, and the problem of suffering. But during these early years, in his sermons, newspaper columns, and Peace with God, he simply delivered this kerygma, the Greek word for proclamation, often used to describe the bare-bones gospel message, with little attempt at elaboration or defense. His task, as he had understood it since the day he knelt by the rock at Forest Home, was not to ask hard questions of Scripture, but to follow the advice of the old revival hymn, Trust and Obey. If a skeptic asked how he could be sure of the existence of God, he answered guilelessly, I spoke to him this morning. Or told the story of a boy whose kite had disappeared in the clouds, but who knew it was there, because I can feel the tug. Such answers did little to help inquirers who were truly struggling with theism, but they were sufficient for the many in his audience who needed only a one-liner or an anecdote to make them feel they had wrestled with the world's doubt and won handily. As creator and sustainer of the universe, God is able both to raise up individuals and nations, and to bring them down if they betray the purpose for which he has exalted them. He also intervenes as it pleases him, in the minutest aspects of everyday life. Graham did not doubt that God acts directly in human affairs, or that diligent, disciplined prayer would be rewarded with discernible blessings, but he was realistic enough to admit that the correlation between request and benefaction is imperfect. During the Washington Crusade, when asked if he believed God had stopped the rain to allow the rally on the steps of the Capitol to proceed, he replied, I believe God does intervene. I also believe that God did intervene today, as he has in the days gone by when we have prayed concerning the matter of the weather. Then with a slight smile, he added, But in all fairness, I have to remember that we prayed once out in Portland, Oregon, and it poured down. Overall, Graham's view of God during the early years of his prominence emphasized justice and wrath more than grace and mercy. God is not a jolly fellow like Santa Claus, he warned. He is a great bookkeeper, and he is keeping the book on you. I am a Western Union boy. I have a death message. I must tell you plainly, you are going to hell. You listen. Don't you trifle with God. Don't you think you can barter. You are a sinner. You have come short of God's requirements. Your punishment is sure. Graham also believed in an equally real Satan, who stands in cosmic opposition to God, battling for control of the universe and the allegiance of every human soul. His own obsession with avoiding temptation was based in large measure on enormous respect for Satan's powers and prowess. The devil, he wrote, is a creature of vastly superior intelligence, a mighty and gifted spirit of infinite resourcefulness. His reasoning is brilliant. His plans ingenious, his logic well-nigh irrefutable. God's mighty adversary is no bungling creature with horns and tail. He is a prince of lofty stature, of unlimited craft and cunning, able to take advantage of every opportunity that presents itself, able to turn every situation to his own advantage. He is unrelenting and cruel. Fortunately, since God possesses three qualities the prince of darkness lacks, omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence, the Almighty will ultimately defeat the enemy, as Scripture teaches. But his power and craft are so great that only those safely inside God's mighty fortress, the Church, will be able to resist him and escape eternal damnation. The cornerstone of Graham's theology, of course, was his unshakable belief that the Bible is God's actual word. His literalism required him to reject evolution of the human species and to believe that Adam and Eve were actual historical beings, created full-grown with every mental and physical faculty developed. But it was Adam's nature, not his origin, that played the key role in his theology and preaching. Adam, in the Orthodox evangelical view, was created sinless, but equipped with free will. Because he used that freedom to disobey God and eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he fell into a state of sinful, guilt-ridden rebellion against God, a state passed along to all of his descendants. Left to their own devices, humans will live a miserable, unsatisfying life and spend eternity separated from God, and the only relationship upon which true peace and happiness can be based. Even in their depravity, however, they possess sufficient reason to understand what they must do to escape from their wretched state, and sufficient free will to enable them to do it. And what they need is justification. A just God, Graham proclaimed, had no choice but to demand that all sin, from Adam onward, be punished by a sentence of death. Since all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, the only hope for fallen humanity was for someone to volunteer to die, physically and spiritually, as a substitute offering to God. In a succinct statement of his doctrine of atonement, Graham wrote, "God demands death, either for the sinner or a substitute. Christ was the substitute. Because he did not deserve to die, since he had not sinned, his merit could be transferred into the account of those who would accept it." Here, then, was the heart of Graham's theology and preaching. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. John chapter 3, verse 16. Graham frequently asserted that only born-again Christians could ever know true happiness and genuine peace of mind. But he never promised that conversion would cure all ills. On the contrary, he warned that the disciplined life of a true Christian could be difficult, and that taking a stand for Christ might create entirely new and quite serious problems. Still, he believed that only the Christian knows how to live, and his thumbnail sketch of the Christian life looked remarkably like an idealized self-portrait. The Christian should stand out like a sparkling diamond against a rough background. He should be more wholesome than anyone else. He should be poised, cultured, courteous, gracious, but firm in the things that he does and does not do. He should laugh and be radiant, but he should refuse to allow the world to pull him down to its level. The hallmarks of Christian life are the disciplined practice of specific spiritual exercises and personal purity, particularly with regard to sex. In a 1952 sermon, "The Life That Wins," he told his radio audience that your quiet time, your prayer time, and the time you spend in the Word is absolutely essential to a happy Christian life. You cannot possibly be a powerful Christian without such a daily walk with Christ. He was able to imbue these words with convincing force because he made it clear, somewhat more frequently than absolute humility required, that he followed such a regimen himself. In sermons and articles and interviews and printed excerpts from his diaries, he often spoke of long stretches of prayer, of praying immediately upon arising, of an entire afternoon spent pouring out his heart to the Lord, of walking out under the starry sky to pray, of a delightful prayer time with a close circle of friends, and of dropping to his knees again and again as he wrestled with some decision or difficulty. Such descriptions, which clearly portrayed him as a spiritual exemplar, could easily have been viewed as immodest and self-serving. They seem also to have been accurate. A person properly fortified by prayer and Bible study would, Graham believed, live a disciplined moral life. In keeping with evangelical practice, he tended to identify morality with avoiding specific behaviors, primarily sins of the tongue and the flesh. He spoke against the profanity he heard among politicians, university professors, and other men in high places, but warned that many common expressions used by professing Christians are simply disguised ways of taking the name of the Lord in vain. He also condemned lying, including the shadings of truth that often occur in business, politics, and everyday social intercourse. As for sins of the flesh, Graham appeared to share the common fundamentalist conviction that alcohol is scarcely less pernicious and damnable than heroin or cocaine, and was willing to put at least a bit of his weight behind occasional last-squeeze efforts at legal prohibition. In 1950, he spoke so forcefully to the Georgia State Senate about the need for an all-out revival against sin that 2 hours later, that body passed a bill to make the state totally dry. The state's House of Representatives, however, managed to arrange that bill's death by neglect. In Jackson, 2 years later, Graham commended Mississippi for being one of the few dry states in the nation and said, "I hope it will remain so." And in his first two feature films, alcohol served as a key symbol of the lost condition of the male protagonist. Clearly, Graham felt the bottle held a powerful demon. Still, far more dangerous than lying, swearing, or drinking was sex, the primary temptation Satan uses to lure people down that broad path to hell. Graham readily admitted to being a sexual person and spoke glowingly of the joys to be found in a God-blessed marital bed, but he followed evangelical practice by using immorality as a code word for sexual transgressions and devoted what was clearly a disproportionate, if not inordinate, amount of attention to sex-related topics. In an early collection of his best My Answer columns, for example, over 100 selections deal with some aspect of sex. Adultery, fornication, petting, pornography, smutty stories, illegitimacy, abortion, rape, impure thoughts, immodest apparel, and living in sin, among others. Graham's basic position on these topics was predictably condemnatory, or at least full of caution. Speaking to teenagers about sexual temptation, he stated flatly, "You'll never make it to the top until you lick this thing, and you'll never lick it without Christ." He pointed out that adultery is one of the few sins for which God demanded the death penalty in the Old Testament, and consistently warned against any behavior that would increase the likelihood of falling into this grievous sin. To a man who defended his ostensibly platonic friendship with a woman other than his wife, he warned, "You are living a double existence, and you are playing with fire. What can so easily start as an innocent friendship has within it the seed of untold sorrow for all concerned, and of the eternal loss of your soul." At the same time, he refrained from a blue-nosed, unforgiving priggishness that would demand some modern equivalent to a scarlet letter. He reminded sinners that as bad as it is, adultery can be forgiven as easily as lying, cheating, or stealing, and told them they must not fear that God would not welcome them back into his loving arms. He told women who suspected their husbands of infidelity that before I did anything at all, I would make certain that my suspicions were justified. If the test proved positive, they should confront the offender directly. I've known men to grow up overnight when wives reminded them that from now on, it is an either-or deal. Moreover, he said to one woman who had failed to take this step, "I must frankly say that your meek silence is in part to blame for your husband's philandering. He either thinks you don't love him, you don't care, or that you're not smart enough to know what is going on right under your nose." To those who wondered if they should confess their past infidelities, he counseled against either a public confession before the church or a private confession to one's mate. "I don't think this is always advisable or necessary. I've known of homes that were wrecked by such confessions." Interestingly, on the question of abortion, which was not hotly debated at the time, Graham ventured that if it were necessary to save the mother's life, abortion might be acceptable, though he felt it should not be employed simply for selfish reasons. Graham's prescriptions for a happy Christian home included a similar blend of biblical precept and common sense. The husband, he said, should provide for the support of his family and serve as the master of the house, the one who organizes it, holds it together, and controls it. The wife is his chief assistant in this work and has every right to expect her husband to be demonstrative, courteous, polite, loving, and gentle toward her, but she is nevertheless to remain in subjection to him and adapt herself continually to his interests, his experiences, his progress. When he comes home in the evening, run out and meet him and give him a kiss. Give him love at any cost. Cultivate modesty and the delicacy of youth. Be attractive. Read as much as you can to keep up on world events and developments. Given his own marriage to a strong and capable woman, Graham had to admit that, in one sense, the husband and wife are co-equal in the home. But when it comes to the governmental arrangement of the family, the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, teaches that man is to be the head of the home. He is the king of the household, and you, his wife, are the queen. A proper queen, he said, would prepare the king's favorite dishes, have the meals on time, make their home as attractive and comfortable as possible, and feel it is her duty, responsibility, and privilege to remain at home with the children. She is not, however, a plaything or chattel without basic rights. She should satisfy her husband's sexual desires, but the decision to bear children should be hers. Surely a woman is entitled to choose when she will undertake the burden she alone must carry in bearing a child. No woman should be called upon to pass through childbirth involuntarily, nor should she be obliged to live in constant dread of doing so. To a husband who asserted his right to impregnate his wife against her will, in my opinion, you are totally in the wrong. You and your wife should lovingly and prayerfully agree on this point. Graham believed children in a Christian home should be subordinate to both parents, and did not hesitate to recommend spankings, pointing out that the pain of corporal punishment, administered in love, is insignificant compared with the evil and pain resulting from the habits of disobedience. Accordingly, he decried modern psychology's tendency toward permissiveness. Psychologists are saying, don't spank your children, you'll warp their personality. I stand here before you tonight in a warped personality, because I got plenty of spankings. There are plenty of calluses on my backbone that were put there by a razor strap. If you haven't had that kind of discipline in your home, you'd better start it, because God demands it. Our children tonight are roaming the streets because there is no home discipline or restraint. Despite these strong words, Graham acknowledged that punishment is inherently negative and that children differ in their reaction to punishment. It may not be necessary for you to resort to the rod. I'm saying, do not be afraid to use it when there is no other way. As for religious training, he cautioned against forcing children to perform unpleasant or meaningless exercises. It is better, he counseled, to let them see their parents pray, to set aside special times for family worship, and to make such experiences as pleasant as possible. Graham felt confident that couples who followed these directions would be able to establish happy homes, a vital need not only for individuals, but for the nation as well. Since almost every historian will agree that the disintegration of the Roman Empire was due largely to the broken home. He informed an Hour of Decision audience that only 1 in 57 marriages ended in divorce when the families were regular in their church attendance. In homes where daily Bible reading and prayer occurred, the ratio dropped to only 1 in 500. This amazing survey, he proclaimed, gives us two significant facts. That divorces in America are mostly among non-religious people, and a Christian home is the best possible insurance against a broken home. Nothing in Graham's theology or recipes for Christian living was unique, or even rare, but he proclaimed his convictions with an urgency and style that caught and held attention, and he undergirded them with a character and personality that made them compelling to those disposed to listen. As he gained experience, first-person dramatizations of the exploits of biblical heroes disappeared, along with his Argyle socks and flashy ties. Occasionally he displayed a purplish school declamation kind of eloquence, as when he declared that the secret of America is not found in her whirling wheels or streamlined industry, nor in the towering skyscrapers of our teeming cities where clever men of commerce meet, nor in the rich, lush prairies laden with golden grain, nor in her broad green meadows where fat cattle graze, but in the faith that abides in the hearts and homes of our fair land. He also sometimes illustrated his sermons with Moody-like stories of the praying mother, who left the front door wide open for years, winter and summer alike, so that a wayward daughter would always know she was welcome at home. Of the father who turned away from the saloon when he noticed his young son walking behind him, stepping in daddy's tracks. Of the fatally ill girl who lamented that her mother had taught her how to dance and smoke and drink, but not how to die. But he was never truly comfortable with either poetry or pathos. And though he acknowledged it was possible to move audiences by eloquence, deathbed tales, and heart-tugging illustrations, he felt the result was too often insubstantial. It may look genuine, he said, but the people are weeping over the story told and not over the conviction of sin by the Holy Spirit. In consequence, these rhetorical techniques came to play less and less a role in his mature style. a style that reflected elements from most of his major forerunners, but that borrowed most heavily from the earliest and latest forms of mass communication in America, the Jeremiad and the network newscast. In the manner of YFC speakers, as well as of many a Southern preacher, Graham usually began by relating a few warm-up jokes, often mangling the punchline to relax the audience and let them know that despite the hard things he had to say, he was really a good fellow, not much different from themselves. As soon as he got through these relaxation exercises, he shifted gears and set about to create a high level of tension in his listeners. He observed that revival is more likely to occur in a time when people feel unable to cope with the problems they face, and he used a variety of techniques to make his audiences believe their lives were filled with such problems. In some sermons, he proceeded carefully from point to next logical point. In others, his subject and text served merely to launch him into a barely related discourse on teenage sex, drugs, loneliness, communism, or atomic war. But whatever the mode of organization, he typically began by ticking off a list of individual or social problems he had observed or heard about on the news or seen mentioned in an article by J. Edgar Hoover or personally discussed with Henry Luce and President Eisenhower or read about in Reader's Digest or gleaned from the works of British historian Arnold Toynbee and Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard and Dr. P. A. Sorokin of Harvard and the famous psychiatrist Erik Erikson and the great Russian novelist Ivan Turgenev. He pointed out that like the rich young ruler in the parable, many seem to have everything but inside are lonely, restless, empty, despondent, and depressed. They seek pleasure in nightclubs and casinos, but their faces wear no smiles when they leave. And even those whose personal lives seem rich and fulfilling must live in a world filled with terror and threat, as a direct result of sinful humanity's rebellion against God. Our streets have become jungles of terror, mugging, rape, and death. Confusion reigns on campuses as never before. Political leaders live in constant danger of the assassin's bullet. Racial tension seems certain to unleash titanic forces of hatred and violence. Communism threatens to eradicate freedom from the face of the earth. Small nations are getting the bomb so that global war seems inevitable. High-speed objects, apparently guided by an unknown intelligence, are coming into our atmosphere for reasons no one understands. Clearly, all signs point to the end of the present world order. These assertions flashed like a fusillade from an automatic weapon, fired in unrelenting staccato bursts that could not be ignored, but allowed no time to run for cover. Indeed, Graham's basic mode of preaching in these early years was assault. To keep entire arenas alert and at bay, he stalked and walked, and sometimes almost ran from one end of the platform to the other, his body now tense and coiled, now exploding in a violent flurry. His arms slashed and crushed and shattered, his hands chopped and stabbed and hammered. His fingers pointed and sliced and pierced, and his words kept coming, a stream of arresting, often violent and frightening images. He never faltered. Never groped for a word, never showed the slightest doubt that what he said was absolutely true. Then when he had his listeners mentally crouching in terror, aware that all the attractively labeled escape routes, alcohol, sexual indulgence, riches, psychiatry, education, social welfare programs, increased military might, the United Nations, led ultimately to dead ends, he held out the only compass that pointed reliably to the straight and narrow path that leads to personal happiness and lasting peace. The Bible says, Billy said, that the only way worth following, the only truth worth knowing, the only life worth living, is that offered to those who acknowledge their helplessness, throw themselves on God's grace and mercy, and turn their lives over to Jesus Christ, who is able to answer their deepest need. Christ died for your sins, he proclaimed. They hung him on a cross, and his blood was flowing, and they taunted him. Come down, come down. You saved others. Save yourself. And he said, no, I love them. I'm dying for people in 1952 in Washington, D.C. I'm dying for those people in generations yet unborn. I'm going to bear their penalty and their punishment and take it upon myself. That offer, Graham stressed, as he moved to close the sale, was the most spectacular any person could receive. But it would not forever be available. Even if Christ did not soon return, each individual's life is a brief and uncertain span. Think, he reminded them, of the movie stars and sports heroes and political leaders who had recently died, some at the peak of their careers. How could anyone be sure he or she would be alive 25 or 15 or 10 or 2 years from now? What about a week, a day? How easy it would be to die in an automobile accident on the way home from the service and then face God at the judgment. Aware of having passed up this one